Thank you. Thank you for this lovely introduction. So now we're changing the language and we're changing the subject a lot as well. So we're getting into a completely different field. So I work in the field of stylistics, which basically uses linguistic tools to analyze the complex literary discourse. Okay, do we have any other stylisticians in the room? No, okay, so I try to make this as accessible as I can, okay, for someone who maybe never heard of this discipline before. Okay, so this stylistics has developed a particular appetite for analyzing characters with unusual minds. So this would be usually characters which have limited cognitive abilities, perhaps some sort of mental repairment or other diagnosis that would skew their perspective into unusual points of view. And to represent this experience of the world that these characters have, authors usually resort to experimental styles full of deviant linguistic patterns. So to project this individual idiosyncratic view of the world, their conceptualization of reality, okay? And the same thing happens, a similar approach can be used when we talk about children's minds, because children also have a limited grasp of reality. They have limited cognitive abilities, and depending on their development stage, they will have a limited understanding of the world, and what is even more important for the author, the limited linguistic abilities. Okay, so one of the ways to tackle this complicated problem of trying to represent children's point of view in literature, which you can compare to, for example, trying to portray another species, right? Because no one knows how children actually think, so it can be quite a challenge. So one of the ways to do it is by using what we call in stylistics underlexicalization. So this is basically when the author intentionally uses very spare and elementary vocabulary to portray represent that this child has a limited knowledge of some semantic fields, okay? And here I have an example taken from Semino's research. This excerpt is told from the perspective of a child character called Alekos. This is from Louis de Bernier's Captain Corelli's Mandolin. And while I read this, I want you to try to imagine what Aleko is seeing here, okay? Okay, so I read, but this time he looked up, perhaps from instinct, and beheld a particularly pretty sight. A sort of white mushroom was drifting down with a tiny man suspended underneath. Perhaps it was an angel. It was certainly garbed in white. He crossed himself and struggled to remember a prayer. He had never heard of an angel that floated above below a mushroom. But you never knew. And it seemed that the angel had a big rock, perhaps a package hanging from his feet on a rope. Okay? So I think it's quite challenging to try to imagine what Aleko is seeing here. What he's actually confronted with is a soldier with a parachute. Okay, but because he has never encountered one before and has no words to describe it, he resorts to language he already acquired. Okay, so the white mushroom is actually a parachute. An angel is a parachute, is in this case a soldier. And then we have this bundle wrapped around his legs, which is probably some kind of a weapon, okay, that he's carrying with him. What Semino argues, however, is that Alekos in this case does not only replace words, so unfamiliar words, with more familiar words, but also replaces less familiar concepts with familiar ones. Okay, so that this doesn't happen only on the lexical level, but the replacement actually happens on the conceptual level. And in this case, this is not a case of underlexicalization, but also of metaphorization. So this is how we usually portray this in stylistics. So we have the source domain. So this is the image that Alekos uses, which is the white mushroom, and the target domain, which is the thing he actually references, so that would be a parachute. Okay. Okay, now getting on to what Maisie knew, which is the novel that interests me. Henry James, the author of the novel, seems to prefer to use similes here rather than metaphors. So I'll read you one excerpt. Maisie heard one of the ladies she found there, a lady with eyes arched like skipping ropes and thick black stitching like ruled lines from musical notes on beautiful white gloves announced to one another. So here we have two similes. One is lady's eyebrows, which are likened to skipping ropes, and the other one's black stitching on white gloves, which looks like note lines. Okay. So what I'm interested in here, is there a significant interpretative difference between using metaphors and similes in these cases? Do Alekos and Maisie think differently? Does that influence how the reader comes to understand the way these two characters are thinking? But before I get into that, I just want to tell you something about the novel so that you get a bit of a context. So the protagonist is Maisie, who is a child of divorced parents, who use her as a sort of a weapon against one another after this vindictive divorce. And she becomes a sort of a pawn in their sly psychological games that they play onto one another. She is passed from one parent to the other, mostly taken care of by nannies and the new partners of her parents. Without the benefit of any proper education, she only has her own instincts to rely on. She is engulfed by the world of adult problems, of divorce, passion, adultery, affairs, which are beyond child's comprehension. But what is crucial here, what is the central mystery of this novel, is what she actually knows. So to what degree does she understand her situation? Because Henry James very carefully keeps this the reader's uncertainty about how much she understands about the situation that she finds herself in. And there is this constant tension between Maisie's shrewdness on one hand, so the way she tackles this all these adult concepts, and Maisie's naivety on the other hand, which is exacerbated by the fact that she sometimes pretends to be more stupid than she actually is, because she realizes that the adults rather like it. Okay, they prefer her to be ignorant. So she practices this art of stupidity, as Henry James calls it. So the central question becomes just how much Maisie actually knows. Okay, and there is this theme of puzzle and games that goes throughout the novel and actually works on two levels. So on intradiegetically, there is a puzzle for Maisie, so what is actually happening. And on extradiegetic level, there is a puzzle for us, for the reader, which is how much Maisie knows. And interestingly, this motif of games and plays actually turns up in many, many similes used in the novel. I put only two examples here. For example, a style that's from a long day's play, or when she describes her father laughing, she says it's like some frightening game. So it's very it's a very clever way of woving this motif of games into the novel. But I now want to come back to metaphorical language in the differences between how it's used in Alekos and Maisie's case. Okay, so with Alekos, we've seen that he uses, the author uses metaphors, which are so-called metaphors in absentia. So these are metaphors which have implicit target domains. So he doesn't tell us what the white mushroom, for example, refers to, but leaves us to guess. Okay. On the other hand, in Maisie's case, similes are used which have an explicit target domain, because simile inherently, because of its grammatical form, will always have explicit target and source domain. So it seems as if Alekos confuses one concept with another and completely blends them. So there's no difference. He doesn't make any difference between the soldier and an angel. While Maisie seems to recognize the similarity, but also the dissimilarity between the two concepts. So she seems to be aware of this, of inaccuracy of her metaphorical gap filling. Okay, she uses metaphors only as a sort of a crutch to help her understand the world, but doesn't actually confuse the concepts with one another. And all this comes down to the grammatical form of simile. So I want to talk a bit about the simile, about the nature of literary simile. Literary simile has been sort of swept aside in linguistics and stylistic as a sort of a metaphor-spore relation, okay, because it's a more obvious metaphorical structure. It always has this glaring word like, okay, it cannot exist without this word, so it sort of calls attention to itself. But precisely because of this overtness of similes, we get a different stylistic effect. So here I have two examples. So we have the sun is a golden apple. This would be a metaphor, okay? And then we have the sun is like a golden apple. Now, if I tell you to list differences and similarities between the sun and an apple, I'm pretty sure you'd come up with more dissimilarities than similarities, right? So this word like actually warns us that we are comparing two things which are similar in one aspect, but dissimilar in all the others, okay? So this is what makes simile a device that expresses similarity between two essentially dissimilar things. So there is always some epistemic modality in simile. It always has this nuance of uncertainty, this negative shading, we call it in literature. So to explain this a bit better, I want to give you another example, which comes from a study done by Elizabeth Black, who discusses William Golding's novel The Inheritors. Now, this is a very interesting novel which is written from a perspective of a Neanderthal, and the main character, Locke, initially uses metaphors, similar as we've seen in case of Alekos. So here he says Locke drew the stick back, but the stick actually refers to a bow, okay, for hunting. Right, so Locke doesn't differentiate between things which have similar shape or color, and then he gradually discovers the word "like" as he begins to understand differences between things. Okay, so here you have, for example, he describes Homo sapiens changes shape like a bear in a cave. And this is how evolution or progression of a Neanderthal is portrayed in the novel. And something similar happens when we have children characters and this progression of their thinking is being portrayed. So taking in consideration what I've discussed so far, a claim can be made, so we come to a realization that stylistic actually does not make a difference between metaphors that are being understood as metaphorical by the subject who uses them. Okay, so in the case of Alekos, he is not aware that he is using metaphorical language. For him, he takes this literally. For him, the soldier is an angel. So this becomes metaphorical only on the reader level. So it's us who understand that this is actually a metaphor. While in case of Maisie, she seems to understand herself that she's using a metaphorical language. So it becomes figurative on the character level. And then, of course, also the reader has no problem figuring this out because simile is so explicit. And this does not end our discussion just yet, because I've been neglecting one aspect so far, and this is the narrative context. Okay, so now I want to put these metaphorical structures into the narrative text to see how they interact with the surrounding discourse. So this might be a bit complicated to explain, but let's try it. So in the case of Alekos again, you can see that that the narrative mode that de Bernier uses here is actually direct thought. So when it comes to metaphors, he uses direct thought. So this means that he expresses Alekos' thoughts directly without embedding it into a reported clause. Okay, so he reports thoughts as if Alekos would say this out loud. Okay, a sort of white mushroom was drifting down with a tiny man suspended underneath. So the narrator here does not intervene. But in case of Maisie, we have something we call psychonarration, which is when the narrator is expressing, is trying to express emotions or the psychological life of a character. Okay, and here the narrator actually mediates the thoughts of Maisie. So the narrator has a stronger grip on the narrative. He directs the reader. And what we get in psychonarration is this ambiguity between which parts of this discourse actually belong to Maisie and which parts to the narrator. So you can see here, for example, in the simile, Henry James uses the word drops instead of stairs, because Maisie has no word for stairs. Okay, so he sort of orients the narrative towards her mind by using this. So in psychonarration, so this is free indirect style, if you've ever heard of it. It's typical of modernist novels, okay? And this is also what sometimes makes them very difficult to read, because you have to know what to attribute to the subject and what to contribute to the narrator. And what simile actually allows Henry James here is to sort of slide from the narrator's perspective to Maisie's perspective by using this simile. And this creates this sort of a seesaw effect, as I called it. I was inspired by Dorit Cohen's description of similes being this seesawing of similes. She talks about seesawing of similes. So we slide from the narrator, from the narrator's perspective, into Maisie's perspective mid-sentence. Okay, so it's a very neat way to change perspectives and also create this ambiguity of how much of this is narrator, how much of this is Maisie's, and then again, how much Maisie knows. Okay. So this concludes my presentation. So what we can take away from this is we can think about what are motivations for using, for example, literary simile instead of metaphor in the eyes of an author. So first is this explicitness of similes can influence the way we see a character. So it will be a character which is more self-aware, which is more shrewd, someone who understands more. And then this change of perspective mid-sentence can be also a motivation when we look at the narrative technique of the whole novel. And that's all for me. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I will quickly stop the recording.